This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Hello, welcome to the Ahval podcast. I'm delighted. My name is Nevana Mahmoud, and I'm delighted to have this podcast with Stephen Cook. He is a senior fellow of the Council of Foreign Relations in DC, and he kindly agreed to have this interview early Sunday. So thank you very much, Stephen, and welcome.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to be with you, Nirvana, and congratulations on the new podcast. It's a wonderful it's a wonderful opportunity for you, and I'm glad to be your first guest. Excellent.
So you wrote recently a fantastic article on in foreign policy about Erdogan and his luck and how he got his groove back in domestic politics, at least. Right. And I saw that a Turkish newspaper, Aydınlık, have put your photo and called you, in my poor Turkish, maybe somehow like a troublemaker, because yes. Fitna. And I'm not so sure where is the fitna. I actually saw that you are praising Erdogan, because you saw that he had a tumultuous, which I agree, of course, he had a tumultuous, difficult few months in Turkey with all sorts of stuff going on, from the student protest, then they cancelled the Convention of Women's Rights, and now this, and the HDP and all this sort of stuff. And then the icing on the cake came with the letter of those retired admirals who warned about the cancellation of the Monroe Convention. And also the second part of the letter, they talked about the risk of Islamizing the army. And I wonder, you talk that this letter is like a gift to Erdogan. So I wonder first if you can highlight why.
Well, first of all, let me just say that, I'm not sure that the headline writers at Aydınlık knew, but when they called me a troublemaker, it made me very, very happy. And they actually used a very nice photo of me. So, you know, and if the folks at Aydınlık, which is this ultra-nationalist paper and ultra-nationalist group of people around it, if they're the ones who are criticizing me, I guess I'm in a good place. So I guess it was a win-win-win for me. It didn't really bother me. And it also gave me an opportunity to mock them a bit on Twitter. But in all seriousness, I think they did misapprehend one of the points of the piece, which is that, you know, for all the criticism leveled against Erdogan, and he deserves much of, you know, all of it, as far as I'm concerned, he happens to be a quite extraordinary politician. And I've always maintained that I think that my Turkish critics respond in a way to the things that I write inappropriately, because I actually have a tremendous amount of admiration for Erdogan as a politician. He's always seems to be one step ahead of his opponents. Now, what the real story is with the admiral's letter, I don't think anybody will ever know. It's like the attempted coup in 2016. People believe that, you know, he staged it. It was a coup. It wasn't. Who knows? Same thing with the admiral's letter. How and why this came about, and if this was just kind of an innocent strategic miscalculation on the part of the admirals, or they were set up, or whatnot. The important thing is the political effects of it. And this is what I was talking about when I called it a gift from God. And yes, I was, of course, playing on what Erdogan said when he returned after the attempted coup in July 2016. He's at the airport in Istanbul, and he called it a gift. He called the coup a gift from God, because he then proceeded to purge all of, he had a further excuse to purge all of his enemies and then some. And the way I see the letter was, Erdogan's had a really tough couple of months. There have been protests at Boğaziçi University. He has he fired the central bank governor after only 5 months, because he was under a tremendous amount of pressure because interest rate hikes, and he's deeply, deeply allergic to interest rate hikes. They pulled out of the Istanbul Convention, which they took a lot of heat from the United States as well as the European Union. Erdogan's been in hot water with the European Union. He hasn't gotten a phone call from President Biden. And the admiral's letter, you know, gave him an opportunity to once again hammer away at the idea that there was a coup was afoot, and to change the narrative about Turkish politics in order to garner support. Whether it works, it's not clear, but it's clearly going to be his strategy that there was a coup. And so either you're with Erdogan or you're with the coup. And that's a kind of powerful political dichotomy that, you know, in the past has worked. He's never been weaker. So let's see if he can do something with it this time.
Absolutely. I agree with you. But, you know, when we chat about that in Clubhouse, there was another Turkish lady came after you left and said that people are fed up with the narrative of coup. And every time say Erdogan that, people start to disbelieve it. The problem now in Turkey, and believe it or not, that's what I heard in one of the Egyptian Clubhouse rooms when they mentioned that COVID is hitting hard and some of their colleagues got COVID, etc. And this is the impact. And today I read in the news that Erdogan ordered the distribution of crops and cereals, on people. So he is clearly aware of the domestic situation. So the question is, obviously now it's a few days after the letter and the detention of the admiral. How do you see that, like, the day after? Do you see people are, the impact of this gift of God between Arabs is still keep giving, or things are dying down and slowing down, well, and you start to forget?
I think we'll have to see, really. I mean, you know, granted, you know, Clubhouse is a really interesting phenomenon in which people can articulate how they really view things in a way that they're unencumbered. But it's very hard to, you know, draw conclusions about what people are saying, you know, more broader conclusions about what people are saying on Clubhouse. I suspect that there are large numbers of people, mostly those kind of, you know, cosmopolitan, let's put it this way, those who aren't necessarily or haven't been part of Erdogan's core constituency over a period of time who don't believe this and discount heavily this talk of coup, because it's something that they've used quite a bit, particularly over the course of now almost 5 years. But given Turkey's history, and given the way in which this kind of thing can be leveraged politically, it is going to be one of those things in his arsenal. And the reason why it's so important is because we are, you know, it's April 2021. We're not that far off from the extended political season that will lead to parliamentary and presidential elections in 2023. Right. And Erdogan is clearly seeding the ground for moving forward. Thus, you have the actions taken against the HDP. Now, whether that closure case goes forward or not, it's still an attack on the HDP. They've done this before. They're determined to undermine the party, seeing that it's an obstacle for a parliamentary majority for the Justice and Development Party. The news that you talked about is really very interesting. I mean, it demonstrates that Erdogan perceives that his domestic political situation is not good. He perceives that the economy is something that is certainly putting a drag on him. And this is the kind of thing that authoritarians do. Now, of course, the Justice and Development Party and the presidency can turn around and say, well, Turks are suffering and we're providing relief. I mean, and this is, you know, this is the basis for much of what not just the Justice and Development Party, the mystique of the Justice and Development Party, but also its predecessors, is that the ability in the years when they weren't in power to garner, to use the provision of social services and charity and those kinds of things as mechanisms of political mobilization. Okay. We'll see if it works. I mean, politics in Turkey, the outcome of elections don't really crystallize themselves till right before. And I feel a little chased because I said that the there was no way that he was going to lose the local elections.
Yeah.
And he did.
Yeah.
And I actually wrote a piece why I was wrong. But again, I mean, we're 2 years out, and it seems to me that he's looking for ways to make up the political ground that he's lost, right, which is a smart thing to do.
Perfect. So now, but the irony is that one of the unintended consequences of that letter is that now the debate about the Istanbul Canal have been reignited. Right. And there is people say it will not affect the Montreux. And obviously, I'm not claiming that I understand or all what I read is what is published about the Montreux Agreement. But the whole idea of the Istanbul Canal, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that it will charge, it want to earn money, like, you know, and that will, in a way, make render the Montreux Agreement somewhere ineffective. And now I'm moving to the foreign policy thing, because Russia, Putin have apparently spoke to Erdogan and insisted that the Montreux Agreement have to be respected.
Preserved, but right.
Nonetheless, he had a three-hour conversation with the Ukrainian prime minister, or president, if I'm not, sorry. And now it starts to become so messy, because now the Montreux Agreement is right in the heart of the foreign policy conundrum for Erdogan. How do you see that?
Well, first on Montreux and the Istanbul Canal thing, you know, I think a lot of times we tend to discount because of the way in which the Justice and Development Party, in particular, the way President Erdogan has behaved over the course of, you know, arguably the last decade in a kind of thuggish way. We tend to discount good reasons for potentially good reasons for doing things. And so the Istanbul Canal is not such a crazy project when you think about it, and especially when you think about it in the context of what just happened in the Suez Canal. Anybody who's, you know, stood on the banks of the Bosphorus Strait and watched the shipping traffic and watched and if you've been on a boat on the Strait and you see that it's narrow, it's windy, that it is there with, you know, modern shipping, it can get very dicey going through the going through the Strait. Yeah. So there is some reason to think about some alternative to the Black Sea. Of course, yes, like the Suez Canal, where Egypt makes money, Turkey would ostensibly make money from the Istanbul Canal. Now, set that aside for a second and think about what it is. Now, first of all, I think that the Montreux Convention kind of thing that came up in the Admiral's letter was, it's funny because it really wasn't something that they were talking about seriously. It was sort of like an offhand thing that was mentioned. Well, yes, we could change the Montreux Convention. But where it gets really sticky now is with this Russian buildup of forces on the border of Ukraine. And this is where Erdogan finds himself hammered between his relationship with Vladimir Putin, his NATO membership, his kind of chilly, frosty relationship with the United States, with President Biden, and what's happening. And obviously, Putin would like to preserve the Montreux Agreement because it limits the number and time that warships from non-riparian states can stay in the Black Sea. Right. So right now we have two American warships that are up in the Black Sea providing support as a demonstration of support for Ukraine. There's only two that are allowed, and that they have to leave by early May. If there was some sort of change in the Montreux Agreement, that might benefit Turkey's NATO allies, much to the chagrin of the Russians. So, and then you have, of course, this buildup. And Erdogan has sort of developed this relationship with Putin. It's been quite compartmentalized over a period of years. He's purchased the S-400. It has made his NATO allies, particularly the United States, unhappy. And then there is this NATO concern over Ukraine, which is not a NATO member, but of course, the question of Russian arms. And I think that Erdogan is really caught between the United States, NATO, Britain and on one side, and the Russians on the other side. And the Russians really, they're not the United States, which basically gives the Turks a pass very often. And the Russians will make the Turks pay for any kind of betrayal here or anything that they perceive as undercutting their policy on Ukraine, which is, you know, I'm not a Russia expert, but from what I do know, Ukraine is critical not only to the security of Russia, but also a sort of kind of Russian identity. So it's very, very important. And the Russians have already cut off flights to Turkey, which is a very important Russians. There are lots of Russians who go to Turkey, tourism, trade, these kinds of things. So I think Erdogan's in a quite precarious position. I think his His hope is that the Russians do, you know, make their point and then pull back, and he's not in this awkward position. But meanwhile, he's selling drones to the Ukrainians, which those Turkish drones have proven themselves to be extremely effective in Syria and in Libya and against Russian forces. Yeah. So it's a super interesting and it's a super interesting situation to watch. And I think it puts Erdogan in quite a bind.
Perfect. And I agree with you. We'll have to watch and see how the Sultan, with his fantastic political skills, will get out of this snooker.
The relationship with Russia is really quite extraordinary because, you know, Turkey and Russia are on opposite ends of the conflict in Libya and Syria, Ukraine, Nagorno-Karabakh. Yet the Turks have wanted to compartmentalize these differences in an effort to work with Russia in order to preserve economic ties, in order to preserve those tourism ties. And I think, you know, the Turks, like the Russians, don't like American predominance in the region. The Turks certainly, I mean, it's obvious that the Russians don't like American predominance in the region. Yes. This is payback for Putin. But for the Turks, they want to have freedom of maneuver and an independent foreign policy and be treated as a great power,
but still,
as they believe they should be. And that means working with the Russians kind of against the United States in ways. So yeah. it's a really interesting thing. There's, you know, folks who are kind of sympathetic, I think, overly sympathetic to Turkey's position in a way that doesn't reflect on them well as analysts, yeah, are constantly banging away at the fact that Turkey and Russia find themselves on the opposite ends of the conflict. Therefore, ipso facto, Turkey must and can be this bulwark against Russia for the United States. And to me, it's just much more nuanced than that. I don't think the Turks look at it that way. I think that they want to have a relationship with Russia that's useful to them. And it's useful to them in a number of different ways, whether it is whether it's articulating a way of articulating their independence, bolstering trade, economic well-being. I mean, after all, when they acquired the S-400, or in the days before they acquired the S-400, the very powerful Minister of Interior called it Turkey's Independence Day. So Russia is useful.
Yes, anyway. I understand. I just want to add, because I before I forgot, I can't help it, and I'm sorry, Stephen, but the sofa gate is so sexy. And I wonder, you know, you mentioned the gift from God. Do you think God have retracted his gift only a few hours or maybe a few days after that?
Because over Sofagate?
Yeah, it came on unexpectedly and it's shockingly and somehow put out again on the back feet, correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. I know there's an Ottoman joke in there, you know, Ottoman the furniture joke in there, but I can't figure it out. Look, I think... I think it reflects a sort of worldview on the part of Erdogan and the, you know, kind of leadership of the Justice and Development Party. This is, you know, and coming as it did after the withdrawal from the Istanbul Convention, it's really not a good look for the Turks. And more broadly, I think, you know, you have these two European leaders come not long after the admiral's letter, and yes, you would have thought that it put Erdogan in a good position. And then you have Sofagate, and that overtakes everything. Still, I think, you know, with the Europeans, and obviously you know this well, you know this better because you're closer, Europeans are a lot of kind of fury at Erdogan and the Justice and Development Party, and very little in the way of action. And they'll always kind of, it strikes me, they will huff and puff. And then at the last minute, the Germans will say, oh, no, we can't do this. We're worried about refugees. We're worried about economic meltdown, those kinds of things. And then, of course, the UK government, obviously not part of the European Union, but the UK government has in some ways been a bit of a, I don't know, sort of like a cushion for the Turks.
Yes,
you know, they're both outside the European Union. The UK government has been has soft pedaled a lot of the kind of worst excesses of the Turkish government, kind of overlooked the kind of aggressive posture of Turkey in the Mediterranean. These are things that I think, you know, even though the UK is outside the European Union, I think, you know, Europe does not really have a unified policy on Turkey. And so you'll get a lot of angry rhetoric and talk about sanctions that never really materialize.
Correct. And I, you know, it seems like Erdogan in the last few months have a mix and match of blessing and damnation. Like, and it's a very funny bag. I can't remember any time in the last few years he had this mixed bag in a very surreal and, you know, bizarre way. And as you rightly mentioned, it remained to be seen. We will have to watch and as like a Netflix series, how he gets out of all this.
That's right. You know, we are in a, it's hard to remember. It's been 19 years since the Justice and Development Party won the election in November 2002.
Yeah.
And then Erdogan became the prime minister in March of 2003. It's been around for a very, very long time. There's been lots of twists and turns. There are people in Turkey who really don't remember anybody other than Erdogan. You would think that he would have outstayed his welcome. And I think that there are strong indications that he has. The polling is weak. I mean, still, Justice and Development Party would win the most votes, but they wouldn't have the all-important parliamentary majority. So I think you're going to see in Turkey in the coming months lots of twists and turns, fair amount of political instability, you know, zigzags on policies, where Erdogan is looking for every possible way to gain an edge and an advantage. And, you know, this is the way he gets his groove back.
Fantastic. Zigzag on policy. I think that is sum up this episode perfectly. I would love at some stage, if you're generous enough, to have another episode to talk about my beloved Egypt and its relationship.
Oh, of course. That would be a tremendous amount of fun. And then we can do another one and you can give me medical advice.
Deal.
Okay.
So we'll talk about maybe in part two at some stage Egypt and Greece, because the Prime Minister of Greece is due to visit Turkey next week, I think.
Yep.
So that will be very interesting, especially they accuse Greece of harboring terrorists. But on that note, I would love to end this podcast. I don't want to make it so long. Thank you so much for your time, Stephen.
It's the pleasure's mine, Nirvana. And once again, congratulations on the new podcast.
We'll end it now and speak soon.
Okay, thanks.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.